talk to probably the most well-known American poet. When Larry was announcing the session today at breakfast, at least at second breakfast, he said, Robert Frost, the poet laureate of the United States. We do not really have a poet laureate per se, that is the poet elected by the government, chosen by the government. In England, it's the Queen. Wordsworth was a poet laureate for a time. All the famous British poets that you know, except Shakespeare, they were, he was not a poet laureate. They had just not established the tradition then. But with the arrival of John F. Kennedy and his inauguration, and also with the arrival of his administration, in which, and if you remember his administration, it was one that was very much devoted towards the arts. If any of you have been in Washington, D.C. and gone to the Kennedy Center, although that comes after him, you will see carved on the marble next to the Potomac statements from his speeches which indicate his support of the arts. It was also at Kennedy's inauguration that Robert Frost was asked to speak. And so though we do not have a poet laureate per se in the United States, in many ways he was our poet laureate. I want to talk for a couple of minutes, and it will be very brief, first on Robert Frost as a person, then on his art, and then move most importantly to his poetry itself. Robert Frost lived a very long life. He was 89 years old when he died in 1963. That is a very old man, even in our culture. He was born in California. We always think of him as a New England poet, and he did move to New England at a rather early age, but he was born in California. He lived a very rich, full life. Though we think of him in many ways as a sort of reclusive New England poet, he very much was not one. And at 86, 3 years before his death, when he gave his, when Kennedy became president, he in a way, as I suggested earlier, was made poet laureate. Also, John F. Kennedy asked him to give a poem, to write a poem for his inaugural address, for his inauguration. And Robert Frost did indeed do that, and he wrote a poem. It's very, rather sing-songy, it's rather, it's very historical. It's not really very interesting. It was sort of a history and rhyme of the United States, if you will. But if you remember anything about that inauguration day, or have seen slides or films, or have even heard Kennedy's inaugural address on tape, you'll hear that the wind is always hitting the mic. You get a very fuzzy tape as a result. But it was a very cold, windy day. Frost was 86 years old. He was pitiably inaudible, even with the great microphones in front of him. There was a great glare also, and you see this white shock of hair coming out of this black coat in which he was. He tried to read this historical poem that he had written, and he lost his place, and the wind started blowing his papers. He got really very befuddled, and so off the top of his hat, top of his head I think had blown off, he recited The Gift Outright, which is a poem that we will be discussing today, and it's really a much richer poem to begin with. It's a part of a poem that had been published earlier. Robert Frost had a very testy, almost a truculent personality, really. He wrote off critics, which maybe any artist has to do. He did not take criticism gracefully either. He refused, however, to listen to what they had to say. Yet he was generally a genial man, genial in the sense that he liked to talk a great deal. He went to a great many writers' conferences, such as Breadloaf in Vermont, or Middlebury, and he would often talk to aspiring poets, though he was not always helpful to them. He would talk about his own poetry, how he goes about writing his own poetry, but he would not say, oh, this is your poem, let me work with you on it. Look at this, needs to be revised. Don't you think that the rhythm is wrong here? You need to find your own voice. He would never do that, partly because he was a rather jealous, envious man. He was, however, a great talker, and he liked to talk to individuals, primarily about himself as well as to groups. He also had a keen interest in life and all kinds of things. And perhaps that's what always made him seem young. Even when he was old, and he got rather physically old, as well as chronologically old, but then he was 89 when he died too. I guess he has reason to have arthritis. He had a wide variety of interests. There's a description, for example, that he wrote on how to wash black socks properly. Also how to handle an axe. He also wrote critical things on the function of poetry in the modern age. He wrote prose as well as poetry. He would often give readings, talks at places such as Harvard, places such as Middlebury. He had a farmhouse himself in Vermont. He spent a great deal of time there. He also traveled a great deal to New York, to Russia, to Washington, D.C. When he was past 85 years old, he made his last trip, which was to Russia, and there he met Khrushchev. He was certain, though he writes often from the point of view of a reclusive New Englander, he was not. He was very much of a sociable and a public person. As I suggested earlier, he was born in California, north of San Francisco a bit. At age 11, he moved to New England. And it was his decision to stay in New England. He liked New England very well. He became a New England poet in the sense that there's the sternness of the New England manner in his poetry. Also, there's the toughness of the rural atmosphere. He does not write poetry from the point of view of a Boston sophisticate by any means. But in his poetry, there's always a closeness of nature, but not the expansiveness that you will find in the poetry of the West, for example. He will be talking about little things, about stone fences, about small flowers, not for example, about the great expansiveness of the landscape in Wyoming, for example. Much of his poetry is pastoral, that is, it has to do with things that are rural. Also, there's throughout his poetry a discussion of the common man, of tramps in mud time, for example. This is the title of one of his poetry, or farm wives, people who were very much a part of the earth. He is one of the very much respected American poets abroad, particularly in England, and the British are always suspicious of our cosmopolitanism. We're only 200 years old, they say. How can we possibly have any intellectual sophistication? But his country poetry, his simple language, his simple wisdom really makes him very readable and makes him popular, even in Britain. His style is characterized by brevity. Look at these poems, they're short. Now, he does have some narrations which are longer, but even those are quite brisk in their narrations, quite brisk in their dialogues and their conversations, and he doesn't have poetry, or he does have some poems that are conversations between several people. There's also very much a clarity of description. He's not flamboyant. He's not puzzling as E.E. Cummings is, for example, or as Cummings has been accused of being so cute. He's certainly not intellectual like T.S. Eliot. You don't have to be familiar with tarot and the Divine Comedy and every piece of classical literature ever written in order to read Robert Frost, as you have to with T.S. Eliot often. His poetry really lacks exaggeration, as the New England mind still does. The New England consciousness is really quite different than the Western consciousness, for example. The meter is going to be the cadence of common speech, and much of his poetry is dialogue. There certainly isn't the pomp and the fuss of language, the working with the puns that we have in other poets, American poets. His speech is often colloquial, partly because there's a lot of dialogue poetry. The transitions he uses are going to be transitions that we use in our daily speech, the of course, admittedly, that kind of thing. Okay, well, let's turn to some of the poems themselves. But before I do that, maybe I should say something about the sort of scheme or schema that Robert Frost uses, and I've marked it out here for you. Robert Frost's poetry all has to do with relationships. And his idea of the universe is very different, really, than the way that that we as a Christian community view the world. Because at the center of his universe, at the center of Frost's universe, is his self, is the individual, the own individual being. Beyond that is society. Beyond that is nature, the things of the world. Beyond that is the cosmos, the sort of, I think in terms of physics and the world of space, the world out there. And then beyond that is the metaphysical. What we think of is probably God, though Frost's idea of God is, again, very different than the Christian idea of God. There's a great deal of irony that runs through, that runs through Frost's poems. Look at the last poem, for example, on the bottom. This is an untitled poem. Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. Kind of clever on the one hand, but if you think about it seriously, it's a rather arrogant way of viewing God. And yet, feels rather. I think the poet here also feels rather despairing too about his befuddlement in the world. Another poem that you're probably familiar with is the last one, Fire and Ice. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if I had to perish twice, I think that I know enough of hate to say that for destruction ice is also great and would suffice. Okay, some say the world will end in fire, some say the world will end in ice. All right? What does he mean here? What does he mean by fire?
Consuming hatred, maybe, or something? Pardon? Or consuming hatred, something on a level of a passion or desire?
Okay, right. And he makes that specific. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. What does he mean by desire here?
I like Bill's word of consuming, sort of that which would desire that would consume or burn up or take to itself, sort of greed. I almost think of greed, compassionate greed.
Mm-hmm. I think almost really of things more physical here, as opposed to hate, which seems to be things more intellectual, such as greed, such as malice, those kind of things. And in a way, we succumb easier to physical things before we do intellectual things, but the result is the same.
The difference between the two is that desire consumes, fire consumes, and ice just holds at bay, just freezes out. That's sort of the difference between hate that holds things out that would be destructive, and desire that would devour.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Good distinction. Okay, what about Stopping by Woods in a Snowy Evening? Would you like to read this one too?
Yes.
Good.
Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. Between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds that sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep.
Okay. Hey. On very good. Okay, what's this poem about? Just on the very easiest, most literal level. What's it about?
Okay. A cold snowy day.
A cold snowy day. All right, we have the atmosphere established for us. What else can we say about that cold snowy day?
Quiet.
It's quiet, all right.
It's getting dark.
All right. Where is it? What's the location of the poem?
It's like in the country.
Okay. It's a pastoral poem. It takes place in the rural area. It's away from the city, away from wilderness. But yet we do know that there is a civilization because the farmer's house is in the village, though. Okay. Is the man alone? Okay, he's on his horse. Anything else?
The winter solstice.
Okay, winter solstice, all right, the darkest evening of the year. what does he feel about the woods?
They're lovely and dark.
Okay, lovely and dark and deep.
Inviting.
Pardon?
They're inviting.
They're inviting. They're almost luring him. What else? What does he do about the woods?
He has to leave them to go back.
Okay, he has to leave them. He chooses not to go into them, though they are inviting. Okay, that's the sort of plot summary of the poem, and every poem, in a way, has a plot. It's about something on just one literal level. Let's talk about it in a different way. Thinking metaphorically, and I use the word metaphor here, which is a sort of equation. One thing means another, but they're very unlike. They're not similar. They're so dissimilar in a way that they're jarring, they're stunning, and that's what makes a metaphor interesting to us. What else might the woods be to this man, besides simply a woods of trees?
A restful place or...
A restful place?
Escape.
An escape, all right. How do you get that out of it? Anybody else? Why might they be an escape? An escape from what to what?
Well, he's drawn. He wants to go into the woods and it's beautiful and the dark is near itself, so he just crawl into a nice, secure place. And then there's that but. And then the last stanza, but I have promises to keep. It's almost like he feels torn, wanting to stay and just enjoy the beauty and then having obligations.
What's so alluring, what's so inviting about the woods? What are woods? And why are they lovely, dark, and deep?
They're quiet.
They're quiet?
Nobody else is there.
Nobody else is there. What?
They're God's creation.
They're God's creation.
The woods filling up with snow. Snow coming on the trees. I picked that up in the first part that he's. I mean, he says his house is in the village, though, but that doesn't mean. I have the feeling immediately that he's trying to stop and witness God's creation in some way, but he just can't quite do it.
Okay.
He won't go into it. He wants to witness it, but
Okay, well, let's work on some of the pronouns and see what those pronouns would. Whose woods are these? I think I know. Who's the I?
Oh, right.
All right, the poet, and who is the poet?
I thought it was whose woods these are, I think I know. Is this a typo or
no? Whose woods these are, you're right.
It is whose woods these are.
Yeah. Should be reversed.
Okay.
Whose woods these are, isn't that how I've been saying it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, whose woods these are? Okay, who's the I? The I is the poet. The I is also the rider of the horse. Okay. His house is in the village, though. Who's the his here? The his, I think, is not God, but who's...
The
owner of the woods, right. I don't have to be afraid of him saying, don't trespass, don't go in there, because he's in the village. He's in his own house because, after all, it's getting dark and it's cold. So he isn't going to bother me while I sit and watch the woods as they fill up with snow. Isn't that a nice image of the woods filling up with snow as a sort of cauldron that is the receptacle of the snow? Again, let's get back to the woods. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. He's in a way drawn to the woods because there's a kind of mystery there. Not only a sense of mystery, but a sense of losing oneself in a way. This poem has many times been interpreted as a longing for death. And death is certainly one of our ways of escaping life. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. You know, there's something mysterious about death. There's something there that is inviting, that because you don't have to have any of the responsibilities of life anymore, any of the traumas and the burdens and the obligations and all the things that are wonderful about life, but still that make life heavy going. And so there's that fascination with the woods, the fascination with death. And don't we all have fantasies about what death is? And don't we all, how many times as kids did we used to plan our deaths, for example, see ourselves with our hands over our chest in our coffin? There are things that we don't often talk about. Certainly I never went to my mother and said, hey, Mom, when I was supposed to be napping, you know what I was thinking about. But we do. It's part of our psyche. It's part of the way that we relieve our own selves. But there is a kind of fascination with death, and in a way sometimes we do long for it, though we do not choose it, because after all there are obligations, there are responsibilities which we embrace but are at the same time difficult in our various professional roles or personal roles. But I have promises to keep. What does he mean by promises?
I think that's somehow tied to relationship, that the woods are an invitation into self almost and away from the responsibility or the promises of relationship. And the village and the promises and finally the going back, I think, is the call back almost into civilization or into relationship, into humanity. So I don't see the woods so, I guess, death certainly on one level, but more of a turning inward and a going back to that which is most primitive and not so responsible.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we look at that diagram of yours, it's that going,
right.
The center of the eye.
Center is the eye, right.
It's pretty dark.
Right. Yeah. Although in American literature, one theme that comes back again and again and again, whether it's Huck Finn going into the wilderness or whether it's Hester Prynne in The Scarlet Letter, going back into the wilderness, there's always this conflict between wilderness and civilization. And we'll talk about that too in The Gift Outright. But there's something so wonderful about the wilderness, because after all, this is one of the last places, really, one of the last frontiers. The United States is one of the last frontiers. And we always kept going westward. Well, there was always a new green, verdant wilderness there to accept us, and yet somehow we civilized it and we destroyed it. But we could always go on. But he says, I have obligations, I have promises, I have relationships which I must maintain and sustain, perhaps. and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. What does that line mean? We hear that so often, it's almost become.
So many things to do before I can do that.
Right.
Into the woods.
That's right. Whether it's sleep in death or.
So many commitments.
Right. So many commitments before I can just be my own self and do the things that I, as an individual, only choose to do. Notice here how there's a repetition of those two lines and the natural rhythms of speech, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. The repetition also makes it very emphatic, as well as very almost sing-songy in a way, sort of sing-song patterns of our old childhood rhymes. And notice it's the darkest evening of the year. It's the time when one, in a way, can think most deeply. Okay, any other comments on this poem?
I was just thinking of how he uses contrasts a lot that become tensions, like between the woods and the frozen lake, and the darkest evening, which is between the changing
the white of the
seasons,
snow, right?
Right, the silence and then the bell in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow there's a sense as if you were caught between two things, that the poem holds him in attention between two things. It's almost a timelessness. And
mm-hmm.
For just a moment, he's suspended between all these things, and then he moves.
Is the tension resolved?
Well, I think in the repetition, it almost is resolved, because it's as if that indicates motion, that the suspension has been broken, and now something is repeated, and they're sort of
poetically, it's certainly resolved. Yeah. What about intellectually? Is it resolved?
Until the next time he comes.
Right. Yeah.
He wakes up from his reverie and says, "I've got
to go." Right. I've got to go. though in a way, it seems that he's making a conscious decision that he has promises to keep, that he has things to do. But he doesn't really want to. It's the civilization that is calling him back. But he would choose not to do that, I think. A much richer poem, I think, though one that is not terribly familiar.
That's one more comment on this one. I thought we were sure. Is it called consonants when you use vowel sounds to
repetition
and onomatopoeia or something? What's it called when something sounds the way?
Onomatopoeia.
Whose woods these are, I think I know. It's almost like the wind is blowing through there.
Yeah,
and then
that's right.
With the snow and the easy sweep. I was teaching this last year. I never noticed that until I read it alone mm-hmm. a long time. And the third stanza with the only other sound is the sweep of easy wind. And you can just feel the snow kind of just gently kind of brushing across it.
Mm-hmm.
So his choice of words is in the first two lines of the first stanza, and even leading down to the fourth line, just feel, it's almost eerie and ooey and
mm-hmm.
hollow. And
the repetition of the W and of the O sounds.
Yeah.
An owl or the wind, but still the hooing sound, which gives it a kind of mystery, a kind of thoughtfulness as well. And these are the times when we're alone, where we confront something natural. Often that we are most introspective. Okay, any more comments on stopping by woods? Most of you are familiar with that one, and we sort of went over it quickly. The Gift Outright. This is a good poem to read on at the beginning of Independence Week. We celebrate July 4th. Okay, the land was ours before we were the land's. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts, in Virginia, but we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by, possessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak. Until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living, and forthwith found salvation in surrender. such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war. To the land vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become. Okay, read the poem again to yourself, please, and then read it aloud to another person. And don't feel awkward or uncomfortable if you're not accustomed to reading poetry aloud, but it will familiarize you with the poem.
And then by the end, you say, such as she was, such as she would become. It's sort of growing confidence. It's also nice not only to be aware of your own sort of stumbling when you read, but to be aware that other people don't necessarily read poetry with ease either. Okay, let's start out this poem with some of the pronouns too. and this is another difference in style with other more intellectual poets, more cerebral poets. Frost often does not identify his pronouns. You have to figure them out so they figure out who the references are. You know them, they aren't that difficult. But this is the way the common man speaks. I mean, we don't always identify our pronouns. We'll say, for example, I'll say to my husband, well, they're in bed now. And, of course, he knows that I mean the two children. I don't have to say, well, our daughter, Pia, and our son, Pear, are now in bed. We know who we mean. And Frost often does not identify his references. And, that makes him a much more the poet of the people. And certainly he is our poet, more than other poets, I think. All right, the land was ours before we were the land. Who's the ours? Who is the our and who is the we? Who is the we? That's the easiest.
The colonials.
In one sense it is?
Ancestors.
Okay, our ancestors? Our ethnic ancestors?
Us.
Okay, and who's the us? Americans. Okay. All right. The land was ours. What land is he talking about? Okay, this United States, this country, this is talking here really about nationhood and how we achieved our nationhood, how we went about becoming a separate nation, a separate entity. Nationally. Okay. The land was ours before this land was ours. We owned this little land before we were the land. What does that mean? Kind of a conundrum.
I think it's using land in two sense. I think be more of a specific and then more of a general.
Okay.
The land was ours, okay, meaning that's perhaps plot.
Okay. This earth, right,
was ours. Before we were the land, meaning land as before we were Americans or before we were a part of the United States or that idea, a broader
okay.
Nationalism.
Okay, this plot, this particular dirt, these particular trees, in a way belong to us, for after all, we made them ours. Before we were the land, before we had a kind of association with it, before we really became a part of the land. And isn't that true for other things? Remember the first time you moved into a house and you had to be there somehow for the first month or through the first Christmas or something before you really felt that was your home? Or even the first couple of days at Holden, in a way, weren't you an alien until you got to know the routine, until you became a part of what is Holden? Until you gave of yourself so that what you wanted to become a part of could indeed become a part of you. And this is a sort of a general statement for the entire poem. The land was ours before we were the land. We owned this land before we really were Americans. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. Okay? What does that mean? She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people.
And the people still belong to Great Britain.
To whom?
To England.
Okay, all right. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. Okay? We own this land, but the land in another way belongs to England. We weren't really her people. We lived here. We made this our home, but we were not really a part of it yet. We had not given of ourselves. She was ours in Massachusetts, in Virginia. Okay, why did they use these two?
States.
All right, colonies. All right, and these were the earliest. Massachusetts was, Plymouth was 1620, Virginia was 1607, was Jamestown. Okay, well, you say 1607, and then it says we 100 years before we were her people, and we know that the revolution was 1776. So, you know, there's a time problem here. Well, of course, don't have to be exactly accurate. Also, it was in the 1680s, I think. Wasn't it that the last colony was really established? Wasn't Georgia the last colony? I've forgotten what order they're in. I have to go back to my American history.
Well, it was until the late 1800s before ladies saw a lot of it. I mean, the land.
Right, right. But he's talking specifically, I think, those 100 years, right, about being England, because after all, we were England. In what way were we England? When we owned the land here, what way were we England? Okay, all right. And we were a part of her government. Still colonials. All right, what's suggested by the word colonials? All right, obviously, we were still part of it. We were still colonies. We were still governed by England. But what also does he mean by colonials?
Still have the habits and things of England. They just translated it into America. That's another thing with she was our land for more than 100 years before we were people. Like, we still have all of those things that we have brought from England, all of our traditions, everything like that. And it took a couple generations to erase those things, or at least to, you know, draw them out before we got our own traditions in America.
Okay, good. Colonial also suggests a kind of primitiveness in a way here. Possessing what we still were unpossessed by. And he plays a lot with the basic word to possess here. What does he mean? Possessing what we still were unpossessed by. Okay, what is it that we possessed?
The land.
All right, the land. What does it mean that we were unpossessed? What does it mean that, okay, if we possess the land, how can we not be possessed by it? Pardon?
After you move on to the country, you become a part of it, you're possessed by it.
Okay. Okay, in what ways did the early people give themselves to the land or to the culture?
Building it up from scratch.
Pardon?
Building it up from scratch, building homes on it, farming on it. Taking down the woods, making fields.
Okay. All right. Civilizing it. Mm-hmm. All right. Creating our own institutions in it, our sort of American institutions.
And to say it to the last line, unstoried art looks unenhanced.
Okay.
The building is there, the folk art. Folk.
Okay. What does it mean, unstoried? All right, there were no tales, no legends. I mean, the early American writers had a devil of a time trying to come up with things. The story of Rip Van Winkle, for example. You know, Rip goes up in the hill and he's this lazy bum, and then he goes up in the Catskills and he drinks too much and plays tin pins, and then he falls asleep for 25 years. I can't remember how long it is, and he comes back down. The whole world has changed. It's a wonderful story of what happens nationally, too, sort of seeking the national identity. He goes up and he's England, he comes down, he's American, he goes up, he's British, he comes down, and he's an American, a real sort of search for national identity, too. And he's so confused by, instead of King George, he sees George Washington on the side of the hotel, and there's, you know, great industry going on, and
But that story by Washington Irving, though it's made American, though it's placed here and has a lot of obviously American details to it, it's really based on an old German story. The American writers had a devil of a time trying to come up with new material for writing, and Hawthorne, who wrote The Scarlet Letter, wrote it in 1840s or 50s, but it's based on Puritan America. We hadn't had any witch trials to write about. We hadn't had any sort of Puritan mind to write about until we'd lived here a little while. We were unstoried. And in a way, that gives us a new, fresh way of looking at the world, but it also, if you're trying to come up with a culture, it's hard to do. What kind of architecture did the Puritans see when they jumped off the ships? There wasn't any. Okay, what kind of furniture style? You know, it took us a little while to come up with Chippendale and some of those men. Okay, we were also artless. A wonderful word here, artless meaning having no arts. We didn't have any primitive folk arts yet. And at the same time, artless also means innocent, naive.
Something strikes me about this poem is the kind of irony now. How much art and how much story and enhancement there was in this land when our forebears came, that belonged to the native people of this country, but how that isn't even... That
it took a while to discover that even.
Well, it took 200 years to discover that. I mean, it took past frost. I had a sense of frost and even sense that we missed something by not knowing the land as it was. We had to come up with it kind of out of nothing.
Right. But finally, what made us real Americans? It was not just the battle, though the deed of gift was many deed of wars, the legal paper that made, or the sense of property, sense of ownership, came only because we fought for it. And he uses deed of gift and deed of war here. Deeds the first time meaning sort of legal ownership. Deeds next time means act. We had to fight for what. Right. But then there's the wonderful middle section there saying we finally did allow ourselves to we gave of ourselves. There was finally a kind of unity and identity between land and people. And how did this happen? It wasn't until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from the land of living, and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Notice how he plays on word sounds here, lots of repetition of sounds, and alliteration is the literary term that we use. When we found salvation in giving of ourselves to the land, and through that we found identity.
It's sort of like Holden Village in a way, or a church, you know. It means the most to those people who have invested so much in themselves and working for it.
That's right. That's right.
Keep it going. Mm-hmm.
But it's very rich, rich poem. To the land, vaguely realizing westward, it became a reality as we kept moving westward. And of course, there was the whole westward expansion and manifest destiny. Vaguely, because people just set out. There were no roots. The land was ours before we were the land.
This reminds me of Emerson's call for an American poet to somehow tell the story of the country that, so as if in the telling of the story it would be realized.
Mm-hmm.
Whitman is gone on the scene.
Right.
Reminds me of those times.
In his view of the universe, Frost is very similar to Ralph Waldo Emerson.
And Whitman.
Much more interesting.
I sing of myself think that he, even for Whitman, he's the center of everything.
Right.
In some ways, I don't know if Carl Jung talks about grounding. To find a sense of who you are, you have to live someplace and become part of the land. You know, when you leave that land, you still are. There's something internal in you that draws you back. We've all felt that, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's speaking about a lack of that sense of grounding. Don't have any heritage yet. That line,
There was no legacy at the beginning.
The second repetition of possessed by what we now know more possessed than that. Those two lines together, I think, really are key passages, and they're hard to understand.
Mm-hmm. Because he works so much with the word possessed, but yet he changes the meaning each time, and he uses it for the four times in two lines.
The point at which it almost being possessed by, almost like enthralled by, you know, as though the spirit of it hadn't even possessed it yet, taken us over.
I don't know Robert Frost's poetry well enough. Has he ever written anything to tell about what happened to the Native American when his being the land was sort of taken away from him, you know, the American Indian I'm speaking of. They were already, this was already theirs,
right.
Land, and the land was theirs, and they were a part of the land.
Right, but even with the early settlers, there wasn't much co-mingling.
Not with them, but I'm wondering about, you know, I'm sure a lot of poets have recently described the feeling of what's being unpossessed by the land, you know, here they were worried of getting to the point of you didn't really belong to it yet, you know.
But that's a more popular modern view.
Yeah.
It really is.
Gary,
do you want to
read some of that?
Thank you very much.